So we've been looking at the life of Peter these last few weeks. And there's this one time that Peter had a very powerful kind of defining mountaintop moment of his faith, of his life, and then immediately is brought down to his lowest low. And so here's the story from Matthew chapter 16, starting in verse 13. It says, now when Jesus came to the area of Caesarea Philippi. So let me just kind of paint the scene here because the landscape is really important for this story. So here's a picture of Caesarea Philippi. This is way up north of Jerusalem. It's a remote place that was known for pagan worship. There was a temple up there specifically for the Greek god Pan. Pan was the god of nature, of water, trees, all of that. And you can see, like, this is just a gorgeous place, this little waterfall, the trees there, the giant rock formations in the background, that waterfall. The water is coming off of the snow melt from Mount Hermon. It actually flows down into the Jordan River. Those huge rock formations back there, that is part of Mount Hermon in the background. And so this place, Caesarea Philippi, it was dedicated by Philip the Great, son of Herod the Great. It was dedicated in honor of Caesar Augustus, who was the adopted son of Julius Caesar. And so this place was originally called Philip's Caesarea because his dad, Herod, had already built a Caesarea. So that was Herod's Caesarea. So he's like, okay, mine will be Philip's. But it was given to Augustus Caesar, son of Julius Caesar. Julius was believed to be divine. He was believed to be a god at the time. And so it's dedicated to the son of a god who is now dead. That's going to be important later on. But what also made this place just so unique was that there was a cave. If you can see it back there, there's people standing there. There's this huge cave where the water came in, fed into the stream. In this cave, there was this deep pool, this chasm there that was believed to be a portal to the underworld. And this was important for pagan worship. And so their version of the underworld is Hades. You might remember that from Greek mythology. And if you remember last week, we talked about the Sea of Galilee, the deepest part of the Sea of Galilee called the Abyss, that was also believed to be a portal to the underworld. So same thought happening here, right? So just imagine this, right? Jesus is up here with his disciples standing here in this place that is dedicated to a dead god in essentially a temple of pagan gods. There's an alleged portal to the underworld beneath them and these huge rock formations rising above them. I mean, just you got to imagine this scene in your mind. Place yourself there as we hear the rest of this story. So here it is, verse 13, the story goes on. It says, Jesus asked his disciples while they're standing there, right? Who do people say the human one is? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the other prophets. Jesus said, what about you? Who do you say that I am? Simon Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Then Jesus replied, happy are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because no human has shown this to you. Rather, my Father who is in heaven has shown you. I tell you that you are Peter. Now, he gives Simon, son of Jonah, a new name, Peter, or Petra in Greek. And it means not only rock, like a stone, that would be the Greek word lithos. Instead, Jesus says Petra, which is usually referred to as this, like, this massive rock, like a boulder or like the side of a mountain. And so Jesus calls Simon Peter, Petra, against the backdrop of this 70-foot tall wall of rock rising above them. I mean, you get the play on words here, right? And Jesus says, he continues on and says, and I'll build my church on this rock. He didn't mean the literal rock of Caesarea Philippi and Mount Hermon, but instead the strong, impressive, rock-like faith of Peter, that Peter would be the bedrock of faith for so many others who came after him, so many others who would build their faith upon his own. Where we're all kind of laying the foundation for the faith and the lives of others that they are building. If you're a parent or a grandparent or a teacher or a small group leader, you're laying the foundation for their faith. If you're in politics or management or some other arena of life, your influence is laying the foundation that others are building their life upon. We are all Petras in one way or another. But Jesus says that using us, upon us, just like Peter, Petra, we're Petras, that he will build his church. It's not our church. Is Jesus's church. We don't build it, Jesus builds it. But it's upon us. Like we got some work to do. And so here at this local church of Jesus, we've been discussing for a while now plans for a new building project here. And so we hired an architect to kind of help create a vision for this building project. Her name is Susan Elfman. And, you know, we sat down with her, we gave her our input and our hopes and our purpose and our dreams and all of that. But she's the one who actually ended up kind of putting it all together, gave us a tangible vision for the vision that we had in our minds. We've gone over at least a dozen renderings of all of these, of what the church could look like physically, drawings just like these. And I was thinking, you know, when it comes time for us to break ground and do construction, every other engineer, every other worker, construction worker, electrician, plumber, that they will be looking at her design, her vision for direction, for what they are to do. And so when we say that we are Jesus's church and that he's the one that will build it, what we mean is that he's the architect. He's the one that has the vision. He puts all of the pieces together. We give input. We do our various parts of the skills and the gifts that God has given us to put into building this thing. But ultimately, it's to build Jesus's vision for his church, not ours. Peter would later go on and he would call us living stones, that we come together. We use who we are, what we have. We come together not to build something of our own, but to build Christ's church. We all have a part to play in it. And so the question for us at our local church is what does Jesus want our local church to be a part of? What does Jesus want his local church here in Dunedin to do? He will build it with us. But we have to be the ones who are following his vision and his direction as the grand architect. That's what he says to Peter. Okay, so back to verse 18. Jesus says, "I tell you that you are Peter, and I'll build my church on this rock. The gates of the underworld won't be able to stand against it. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and anything you fasten on earth will be fastened in heaven. Anything you loosen on earth will be loosened in heaven." And then he ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. Love this scene. So Peter being the favorite, the teacher's pet, right? He shoots his hand into the air as soon as Jesus asks the question, "Who do people say that I am?" And this time, Peter actually gets it right. Like for once, he gets the answer right. And Jesus gives him that look that every teacher's pet just like longs for, right? And Jesus says, "Happy are you. You got it, Simon Peter. Way to go." Sometimes we imagine the scene playing out a little bit like a game of Jesus Jeopardy. Like, "Simon Peter, come on up here for your chance to win the keys to the kingdom of heaven. All you have to do is answer one question. Who am I?" Oh, I know. "You are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Ding, ding, ding. "Yes, correct. You just won yourself the keys to a brand new kingdom of heaven." Dun-dun-dun, right? I know that was a mixing of two shows. Whatever. But Peter wins Jesus' jeopardy, and Jesus calls him the rock upon which he will build his church. And now imagine this, right? All around them, these huge, huge rock formations that have been around for hundreds, thousands, millions of years. And Jesus says, Peter, you're the rock on which I will build my church, my movement, my gathering of people that will not be shaken, that will not be moved, my church that the gates of the underworld won't even be able to stand against it. You know, for the longest time, I had that phrase backwards. Jesus says, I'll build my church, the gates of the underworld, or Hades, or the old King Jimmy Bible version, hell, right, won't be able to stand against it. In my mind, I always read this as, the gates of the church are strong enough to withstand the onslaught of hell. When really, it's the gates of hell, Hades, the underworld, are not strong enough to withstand the onslaught of the church. You see how different that is? The church isn't just sitting on the defense against the forces of death and destruction and chaos and sin. The church is on the offense, pushing back the forces of death and destruction and chaos and sin, meaning that the church that Jesus has built is meant to be actively engaged in the world, pushing back the darkness of sin and injustice and abuse and addiction. The church should be the one who is shouting, screaming at the world, hey, death doesn't get the final victory. We know how this game ends. God has rigged it in our favor. And sometimes, sometimes when we look around, it looks like death is just running up the score against us. We look around at mass shootings and starvation and addiction and sickness and epidemics and pandemics and corruption and injustice and racism and segregation and poverty and cancer and homelessness and on and on. Sometimes when we look around, it seems like the church, the Jesus movement of love and grace and new life, it seems like we're taking a beating. But this is what Jesus says to Peter. He says, Peter, you've got to be the one who tells the good news, that the gates of death and destruction and despair aren't strong enough to withstand the power of love and hope and faith. Tell them, Peter, tell them to take courage and to get to work pushing back against such powers. Church, that's why we can never just throw our hands up in the air in apathy when the headlines come across the news. When we see that the cost of living has become too great for people to pay bills and put food on the table, we don't throw up our hands in defeat. What we do, we put our hands to work and we put food on the table for hungry people. We use our voices and we set our feet to marching. When children are left as orphans or homeless, we don't shrug our shoulders and scratch our heads. We support them. We help them. We raise money for places like the children's home. When the world spews ideologies that seek to separate, divide us, and make us hate one another, we fill people's ears with the love of Jesus and the power of the cross to reconcile us to one another. When cancer takes a body, we pray boldly for healing. And if our friend takes their final breath, we don't sigh in hopelessness. We proclaim the hope of resurrection. And yes, sometimes it seems like small things. Sometimes it seems like we're just throwing pebbles against the iron gates of death and despair. But don't be fooled. Those gates are old and they are rusty. And one day they will come crumbling down. Never stop the onslaught of attacking them with the barrage of good news. Hope is coming. Hold on. Love, give, forgive. Don't despair. Death has already been defeated. The grave is empty. The worst thing is never the last thing with God. There is new life on the way. Love has won. Claim it and then proclaim it with all that you do and all that you say. That's the power that Jesus gives to Peter, the authority that he bestows upon him to preach that message to a world that is full of false idols and a world that so easily bends the knee to death and despair. don't let your hearts be troubled. Take courage, Jesus says, because I have already overcome the world. Peter, that's your message. That's your charge. Jesus gives Peter that authority, hands the keys over to him. You're in charge. Which, really? Peter? Like, Jesus could have chosen, like, maybe a little bit more pious disciple, right? Peter doesn't have what it takes to lead the church. But I don't think that Jesus chose Peter because Peter won Jesus Jeopardy and confessed Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah, the long-awaited king that they had been praying for. Peter gets the answer right, sure. But he's not really the first to get it right or to at least understand who Jesus is. After all, Mary, the mother of Jesus, she really did know who her baby boy was, despite whatever the Pentatonics sing about at Christmas. Simeon sung about it in the temple. John the Baptist pointed to it at the riverbanks. The rest of the disciples were captivated by it when Jesus calmed the wind and the waves. They all knew that Jesus was something, was someone, was special. And so if we're going to call Peter the rock of faith just because he simply got the answer right, I think that that's kind of shaky ground. Peter gives a good summary, a succinct point of who Jesus is. You are the Son of the living God. But I don't think that's the reason why Jesus chose Peter, just because he won Jesus Jeopardy. I think Jesus chose Peter because he knew that just as often as Peter was going to get it right, he was also going to get it so terribly wrong. And just as often as Peter was going to get it wrong, he was also going to get it right. In fact, this moment in glory for Peter only lasts about 39 seconds before Jesus has to call him to the carpet and reprimand him for getting it all so very, very wrong. Here's the next verse. Like, this literally happens next. Verse 21. It says, "From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he had to go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders, the chief priests, and the legal experts, and that he had to be killed and raised on the third day. Then Peter took hold of Jesus, scolding him," began to correct him, correcting Jesus, right? I mean, God, and he says, "God forbid, Lord, this won't happen to you." But Jesus turned to Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stone that could make me stumble, for you are not thinking God's thoughts, but human thoughts." Peter goes from bedrock of the faith to stumbling block of Jesus. CEO of the church to Satan, all within a couple verses here. I mean, highest high to lowest low, all because, as Jesus points out, Peter has some stinking thinking. That he thinks human thoughts and not God thoughts. Which I take to mean that Peter is thinking about selfish things and not selfless things. Peter is thinking and intent on preserving life, and Jesus is intent on laying his life down. Peter seeks after safety and security, and while Jesus, he seeks after the cross and sacrifice. God's thoughts, God's ways are always others first, but our human nature, it's usually about us first. That's the problem with Peter. And so why choose Peter? I don't think that Jesus chose Peter despite these flaws and shortcomings. Like Peter, I choose you, and I'm just going to look over all the times that you embarrass me and you mess up. I don't think that Jesus chose Peter despite all of his flaws and shortcomings. I think that Jesus chose Peter because of all of his flaws and shortcomings. Because really, only a forgiven sinner can preach the gospel. Really, only someone who really knows about God's grace and God's forgiveness is worthy to hold the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Now, I may not give them the keys to my car, but really, only a forgiven sinner can be trusted with the keys to the kingdom of heaven. the keys of the kingdom, Jesus says, anything that you fasten or bind on earth will be fastened, bound in heaven. Anything you loosen on earth will be loosened in heaven. I think nowadays we would say anything you cancel on earth will be canceled in heaven. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if this went down today, like what Twitter would go wild with Peter, right? Bringing up all of his past indiscretions, showing YouTube clips of him by the fire on that night that Jesus was on trial, denying that he ever even knew Jesus to the young servant girl. Jesus says, what you fasten on earth will be fastened in heaven. What you loose on earth will be loosened in heaven. Which sounds a little bit like you get to judge people. Like you get to decide what God thinks of folks. But that's not it. Because that's not Peter, and that's not Peter's life. Peter knew what it was really like to screw things up and to be given grace. That is to say, he knew about fastening and loosing. That when Peter denied knowing Jesus, when Jesus was on trial to be crucified, I can't imagine the self-loathing that Peter must have felt in his heart. I can't imagine how hard it would have been for him to make eye contact with Mary Magdalene the next day. To be bound by such guilt and shame, he knew what it was like to be trapped in a prison of his own making. He needed someone to let him out. He needed someone with the keys to let him out. And not just a therapist or a counselor, that's really great. He needed forgiveness. He needed Jesus. The church can only be built by someone in need of so much grace. Church, we're in the business of forgiveness. Despite what is put out there of what the world thinks the church is about, that there is still loosing to be done in our world. Loosing of shame and guilt and addiction. That the people are bound up in chains of addiction and sin and despair and grief and shame. And what we do is we help loose those chains and we bind people to the love and the grace of God. And we say that while you are yet sinners, while you are bound up in sin, Christ died for you. You're forgiven. Go in peace, beloved child of God. Go and experience the abundant life that God has called you to. You're not bound by sin and shame anymore, but you're bound to God. Go and sin no more. You're set free. We need to be loosed. Amen. We need to be loosened from the things that weigh us down, loosened from pride and hatred, and idolatry, and anger, and addiction, and factions. We need to take out the keys as often as we can and turn to one another and say, you're forgiven. You're free. Walk in grace and peace. Christ has set you free. Don't submit ever again to the bondage of slavery. And so why did Jesus choose Peter? Because Peter knew what it was like to mess up. And also he knew what it was like to be given the grace to not allow his mess ups to define him. Peter's not worthy to lead the church. Neither am I. And neither are you. And yet Jesus trusts us with his keys to his kingdom. Not because we deserve his kingdom, but because we know how desperately we need it. Because we know that we really are sinners. And you know that. You can't even live up to your own standards. I can't even live up to my own standards. We know that we really are sinners. And church, we also really believe in this forgiveness thing. The thing that makes us worthy of leading the church. It's not us. It's that we know the one who is worthy. And so, church, I want to invite you today to confess and to receive forgiveness. I want to invite you to be loosened from sin, shame, and guilt, and be bound to God's love. That's the invitation today. I invite you to join me in these words of a confession. It is a way of saying, this is our faith, this is what we believe, and also this is what I need to hear. That I am a sinner, but I am forgiven. So won't you join with me in these words? O holy God, some days we are quick to declare your goodness. Like Peter, we see you in our midst, and we are confident in our faith. Other days we are distracted and uncertain, desperate for answers. Forgive us for losing sight of you. Some days we are quick to trust your blessings, trusting that we are called, that we can make a difference. Other days, our praise falls silent and doubt creeps in. Forgive us for losing sight of ourselves. We know that our fear and doubt are part of the journey of faith, but for the days when we are far from you and far from ourselves, we ask for your tender grace. Pull us closer toward you. Remind us of the mountaintop moments of our faith. Amen.